This is the Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.starktruthradio.com.
Robert Stark. I am joined here with Guillaume Dorochet. He is a French writer for Owens Review. Guillaume, great having you back on the show. Last time we talked, it was about the French elections.
Hello, indeed. It feels like it was yesterday. Great to be here.
And I'm also joined here with fellow Owens Review writer Anatoly Karlin.
Hello.
So, we'll start things off with the Yellow Vest, and Guillaume, you've not actually written about the Yellow Vest yet at UNS.
No, I haven't. I have avoided the topic because it is still a bit hot, and I'm waiting for things to settle down before we can say many definitive things about it. But I have been following it, and so yeah, I can say a few things about it. I'm not sure what aspects interest you.
So you predict more that it's going to settle down soon, or do you predict an acceleration?
I don't know. I mean, it's transforming. It started out as a protest by fairly ordinary French people, white French people mostly, in the outside of Paris and often in the countryside, against a coming fairly small increase in the gas tax, which was going to happen and has now been postponed. So the protesters have gotten what they immediately wanted, what their immediate goal was. Macron has also bowed down and given them a number of gibes in terms of tax cuts for overtime work, lessened corporate social charges, and an increase in the minimum wage. And there has been a steady decline in the number of people going to the protests. That said, while the protest started as a catch-all kind of negative protest, they are starting to get more concrete or constructive in their demands, namely the civic referendum. So the idea that you could have citizens initiate binding referenda on the government. And I think that is a very interesting initiative. And I wouldn't write off the Yellow Vests because there is a core of them who are always around. And I was in a rural part of France where you could see people still manning the roundabouts and people also going to, and you know, they're doing this in the cold, they're doing this every day, maybe they do it even sleep there. And I also saw people going to town halls, a bit like the Tea Party used to do in America, actually. I think there's some parallels where when Obamacare was being passed, the Tea Party people would rush Congress and talk to congressmen and tell them, don't take over 17% of the economy. And here, in a similar way, they go up to the mayors and the public officials and tell them, we want a civic referendum. So we have to see where this goes.
So the whole issue with the fuel tax, that's primarily a symbolic wedge issue that they picked up upon. It's not the primary reason. It's a reaction against neoliberalism. And the demographics, as you said, is primarily working class whites. So is interesting with the overlap because most movements, you either have left-wing populism and Occupy Wall Street in the United States and right-wing populist movements, which that led to Trump and various movements in Europe. But what's interesting about this is they've pulled the members, and if you go back to the election, which we've discussed, most of these Yellow Vest supporters, they tend to either have voted for, been part of Le Pen's campaign, which was more right-wing populism, or Mélenchon, who was a left-wing populist, most comparable to Bernie Sanders. So, I mean, that's really remarkable. I guess it's been described as a kind of a red, if you're familiar with this concept, it's like a red-brown alliance. But what that's really remarkable is most populist movements are either right-wing or left-wing, but it's not explicitly left-wing or right-wing. It's kind of a fusionism. I guess the closest comparison could possibly be the Five Star Movement in Italy.
I agree with that. I think that is what is very interesting about this movement and might give it potential to go somewhere. And the fellow they quote regarding the civic initiative is a teacher called Etienne Chouard, who is an anti-EU activist. He was against the 2005 European Constitutional Treaty, and he has been promoting this idea of direct democracy and rewriting the Constitution through local constituent assemblies rather than these elites. Now, whether or not you think that is a good idea, he is always explicit about the fact that the people doing these things must avoid the elites who want to police and exclude the right. And these protests have taken place without the agreement or the supervision of the trade unions in particular, because all of the French elites and the trade unions in particular, their job is to exclude so-called far right from, popular movements. If the Yellow Vests can break through that, that will be very significant because it means France can flip. The Yellow Vests are quite heterogeneous as a group. However, it is interesting that I saw a poll, 40% of FN voters identify with the Yellow Vests, and 20% of Mélenchon voters identify with the Yellow Vests. I think it's a legitimate, I don't know what to call it, a slightly leaning right populism, and you do have nationalist groups taking the brand and maybe more or less hijacking it, and I think that's fine, but it is not your usual left-wing populism, for sure.
Yeah, and I think Macron played a major role because, as terrible as he is, because he kind of epitomizes like the neoliberal oligarchy more than any other candidate. The problem is if you get up these different kind of figures, so someone like Trump really energizes the left and that energy on the left, and then if you have a president who's explicitly to the left, then they're going to energize right-wing dissidents. But because Macron, he's neither explicitly right-wing or left-wing, he just sort of epitomizes the neoliberal establishment. And I think Macron, something about his, what he symbolizes in his policies has led to this kind of a fusion of left-wing and right-wing populism, which you rarely see in politics.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would actually be a little bit sympathetic to Macron because I'm personally not against a gas tax, especially for the reasons that they raised, which was ecological reasons. But I think it is part of a generalized revolt against the state becoming too overwhelming in people's lives. I mean, you see it even in driving. They recently brought down the speed limit for regular roads from 90 kilometers an hour to 80 kilometers per hour. In France, you have radars everywhere which prevent you from driving the way you want to. In some regions, they've taken down the speed limit for highways to 110 kilometers per hour, down from 130, which is really quite slow. and the tax rate has gone up from about 40% in 2010 to 46% now, which is a very steep increase in the past less than a decade, past 8 years. And they're doing this because they have to get the budget deficits down. But everybody wants to have their cake and eat it too. Everybody wants to have social benefits and purchasing power, but they want less taxes. And everybody wants job security, but they don't want to have an overregulated market where nobody can move or hire. And people want to stay in the EU and they want to stay in the euro, even though that means open borders and you don't really control your currency. So that's the French people. You know, we're living in a consumer democracy where you need infinity stuff and where the people is always right. And now we're going through the logical consequences of these concepts.
With the gas tax, it's not so much like with the American Tea Party. It's just this kind of like rigid anti-government, like libertarian ideology that free markets are the solution. So some of their ideas some of their demands may overlap with libertarianism, but some of their demands may overlap with the left economically. So it's not so much, it's not ideological, it's thinking about, in a practical sense, what benefits me personally.
And it's been interesting to see that they've benefited from support from most of the population, which is maybe a bit surprising. If you go to France, you talk to people, they seem to mostly support them, I don't know, the polls indicate that there's been a slight decline in support from about, more than slight decline of support. They still have majority support, but it used to be about 80%, and now it's more like 55% support. And I put this down to France's egalitarian, to not say Bolshevik, tendencies. I mean, they did chop off all the elite's heads in 1789 to 1792. And I think, as much as I'm sympathetic to the idea of, an economy serving the people, it's also the case that if you statify and tax France more at this point, it will probably start damaging the economy. I'm not against those sort of things, but just being realistic, I think Macron is not as much a president of the rich as is sometimes said. The big talking point people have, and which has made the left, which made him lose a lot of support on the left, was that he reformed a tax on wealth and changed it to, which therefore affected things like stock options. So if you owned a certain amount of wealth, you were taxed between 0.5% to 1.5% on that wealth annually. And he changed it to a property tax. So now, this is called the ESF, Solidarity Tax on Wealth, and he abolished it and he replaced it with a property tax. So now if you own a house, you will be paying, maybe 10,000 or 15,000 euros a year for that house, which is kind of a lot. Now if you have stock options, you won't be taxed on that. So people see him cutting social services, making it easier to fire people, but also giving a tax cut to the rich, even though it wasn't that substantial, but, that's what it takes.
Yeah, so they still pay more than the United States, probably. I mean, I would say I'm pretty much...
Oh, way more, way more.
So, yeah, it's not that obscene as opposed to, Trump's tax cuts. I would basically say I'm a centrist, or maybe slightly left of center economically. So, I think the amount... one example is the amount of wealth that someone like Jeff Bezos has is obscene. And just the extreme income inequality in the United States, and someone like the very top income bracket should pay more in taxes. And I support some degree of a social safety net, but I also agree if you raise taxes too much, it can stymie economic growth. So I'm not dogmatic. I'm not on the far right or far left economically. I'm fairly centrist and pragmatic, and I get the impression that's where you're coming from as well. Would you say your main grievance against Macron is not so much his tax policies, you say it's primarily his support for mass immigration?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think as far as globalists go, he's trying to be reasonably rational about it. I don't think he completely understands how much the elites are boxing themselves in, but he's denounced repeatedly the high fertility in Africa and said that the high fertility in Africa is a problem and we need to get it lower, otherwise the immigration will get out of control. But he basically wants to turn France into a startup and be young and vigorous and attract the smart people, which is not... It's, you know, a nation is not a company. I mean, that's how I put it. I mean, if you could, you know, get rid of all these peripheral people and just be, you know, Paris and a few tech clusters, that could probably work. But that's only 20% of the population, and that's the 20% who support him, and nobody else really supports him at this point. His decline in popularity has been quite remarkable.
There is this culture of protesting in French culture. There's a number of different factors. I think one of it is just the tradition that goes back to the French Revolution. Americans and Anglos generally don't protest. There's that. I mean, that's like the main aspect of culture, and just rooted in the mentality. So, we had the LA riots in LA, and that was primarily blacks, but also Latinos. But I can't really think of an event in recent history where American whites have gone in a kind of a mass protest. They protest, but for the most part, it's been pretty law-abiding. Two theories that I've heard put out in the OWN's comments section. One of them is that working-class whites in America are very spread out geographically in flyover country, while in France they're much closer to Paris. And the other thing is someone also suggested that American whites are more scared of going to jail than whites in Europe. But the thing is, there is plenty of crime in the white proletariat in America and places like the South, so I don't know about that. But what are your thoughts on the different theories why Americans and Anglos don't engage in this kind of protest, and how significant has it been an aspect of French culture?
Well, I don't know why Anglos don't protest, but protest is a normal part of French life. With every administration, you have mass protests. You had it with Chirac, you had it with Hollande, even smashing things, blocking roads. All this is sort of normal, and the state doesn't really have a way of stopping it. The lack of authority of the democratic French state is quite striking, actually. But I think most of the protests have been peaceful, but the cameras mostly go on the violence done in certain cities and in Paris, where it's always a big free-for-all.
What has been the general role of the police? Are French police generally softer in dealing with protesters than... Well, there has been an incident with the tear gas, of course, but in general, are they softer in dealing with protesters than in the United States? And the other issue I've heard about is that the police may go on strike, which would have a major impact on this. And I also read, it'd be interesting to see what their politics are, because I read somewhere in the last election, Le Pen actually got the majority of votes from police officers.
Well, if the police flip, that would be really interesting. Who knows what would happen then? I really can't gaze the... You see all these videos of protesters misbehaving and of police abusing protesters. I'm in no position to judge, you know, what that means. The French police have a reputation as being harsher than other police in Europe. You have flash grenades, which are shot into crowds and often hit people in the head or, you know, injure them sometimes quite seriously. There was that video, I don't know if you saw, of a boxer beating up police officers and forcing them to back off a bridge, even though the police officers had batons and shields. And that fellow, it turned out, was a professional boxer who is a gypsy. So a native French gypsy, as it happens, not one from Eastern Europe. So, I cannot judge the level of violence, of how bad the police have been versus the protesters.
And another thing about their demands, they're mostly economic. They have not taken a strong stance on immigration. And someone on Facebook commented that they're useless as a group if they don't. But it doesn't matter the official group, because I'm sure I would estimate like 80% of the Yellow Vest are probably opposed to mass immigration.
I don't know. I don't know what the situation is. You do get some Yellow Vests chanting nationalist slogans like "On est chez nous," this is our home. You also had some Yellow Vests chanting Dieudonné's Quenelle song against Emmanuel Macron, which roughly translated is "Manuel, do you feel it? You're getting screwed," you know, something like that. And even singing a Dieudonné song is considered anti-Semitic and quite subversive. So,
oh, he's that comedian from Africa who's considered anti-Semitic.
Correct. Yes, he's the mulatto comedian who invited Robert Faurisson, the revisionist historian, onto a show, and generally likes to annoy the Jewish lobby.
Have there been any Africans and Arabs involved in the Yellow Vest, or it's almost exclusively a white movement?
You don't see them. You don't see them. You see a couple minorities, but it's an overwhelmingly white thing, really.
Yeah, and if I think about the United States, the problem is right-wing populism just has a limited number of... The demographic is limited for change. I think in the United States, the only way for there to be significant change would be some kind of fusion between Trump's original supporters and Bernie Sanders supporters. But that would be very difficult to pull off, just how things are so polarized.
Yeah. I can mention two other interesting things. One is that these groups are completely decentralized. There are no central figureheads, which could work against them, but they are organized via social media. And I was thinking for many years, wondering how will the internet and social media impact on politics, given that it allows for self-organization and free speech on a really new level. And in Italy, it manifested in the Five Star Movement, which is a very interesting development, because it enabled the first nationalist led government in Western Europe, effectively, or certainly of any major country. And in France, it's been the Yellow Vests. Another thing which I find interesting is that everybody is now engaging in conspiracy theories. And the Yellow Vests are frequently accused of conspiracy theorizing. Apparently, some of them thought that the recent terror attack, I believe it was in Strasbourg, was orchestrated by Macron to distract from the Yellow Vests. So that's one kind of conspiracy theory. Another kind has been that the governing party, La République En Marche, the Republic Goes On, so Macron's party, members of his party, leading members in the parliament, members of parliament have accused the Yellow Vests of actually being either caused by Russia, or that their website was founded in the United States shortly after Macron's election, and therefore is a conspiracy by Steve Bannon, and they've actually said this. So that's all very amusing to me. But Anatoly can tell us the real story of how the Russians caused all this.
Yeah, I recently noticed a lot that they were tweeting that, neoliberal, if you see somebody using the terms neoliberal, neocon, establishment, imperialist, then know that this is Russian propaganda. This is becoming pretty crazy now.
It was interesting what you said about the Five Star Movement. That played a role leading to the election of Salvini, but that was one of the first major political parties where you saw that kind of a fusionism. I do think that Le Pen might have a much better chance at getting elected the next French election, but I think is that 2021 or 2022? That's a few years off.
2022, so 3.5 years. I don't know. A relative of mine, believes that Le Pen will get elected the next time because Macron is so unpopular and the center-right is so unpopular. I am pretty pessimistic on that. I still don't think that will happen. I suppose it's not impossible if she normalizes even more. That doesn't make me particularly happy. It is true that if you look at the opinion polls, it's not even called the Front National. I mean, you know, how much do you have to sell out? It's called Rassemblement National, National Rally, and it's the first or second highest polling party along with Macron's party. And all of the other mainstream parties have kind of collapsed. It's kind of amusing. I mean, the conservatives are far behind. They're behind the far left. The socialists don't exist anymore. The fourth leading party is another nationalist party called Debout la France, which is a bit like Rassemblement National, but a bit more moderate. So the political landscape is kind of all melting away. Even the conservatives, who I would normally think it's their game to lose, their game to win, are doing very poorly. Who knows? 3.5 years is a long time. I still don't think she can make it, but maybe she can.
We discussed this on our last show on the French election. On what issues has Le Pen taken more stances that would appeal to the left, like on, say, economics or the environment?
Well, she wants to have local production of things. So this reduces outsourcing, which the left is happy, and it reduces the transit of goods, and so it reduces carbon emissions. In general, she is for preserving the French welfare state. She is for getting out of the euro and monetizing the national debt. She wants to keep public services. I mean, many things. She on the economics, she's basically on the left. They want to have soft money and more or less balanced budgets. But on the whole, it is one of the more left-wing economic agendas, certainly.
And Guillaume, you wrote about the return of nationalist economics in regards to Viktor Orban in Hungary. There's a lot of discussion about his stance on immigration, but not so much about his economic policy. And he has instituted some populist economic policies, including taxes on sectors dominated by foreign companies and nationalizing some sectors. Did a lot of these Eastern Bloc nations adopt neoliberalism after the fall of communism in the 90s?
Well, they wanted to rejoin the world economy, and they wanted to give people confidence that they could invest, and they wanted to imitate the West. And they were facing often difficult and chaotic transitions away from communism. So they had various policy mixes. It was often a big mess. They didn't necessarily adopt full-blown neoliberalism in all sectors. So for example, the healthcare and education and higher education sectors are often still more or less public, more or less communist even. But it would depend on the country. And they had to liberalize many sectors because they wanted to join the European Union to get access to the EU market and to EU funds. But once they're inside it, they can kind of break the rules and do what they want again because the EU is not really able to enforce things. And so Orban has put taxes on multinational corporations, put taxes on banks, and is generally successful in his economics. I mean, there's a partially legitimate fear that these populist movements and contestatory movements are economically incompetent because they're based on emotion and because they are, the underdog. But Orban has, his economic performance is by no means, particularly better than anyone else in the region. But it's not bad. And I think in general, if you have local economics, and in particular, if your financial system is not too much enmeshed with all the others. You know, you shouldn't be getting citizens indebted in foreign currency. You should not be getting into debt. You should not be massively investing in other countries' financial systems where if they have a recession, suddenly your bank collapses. They've been quite careful to renationalize the financial system, because that's how he came to power, on the back of the socialists in that country collapsing with a financial crisis.
So there actually is a major socialist movement in Eastern Europe. I mean, most people assume that everyone, American, right-wing Americans, will assume everyone in Eastern Europe hates communism. Remember in the Czech Republic, I saw some older working-class guy in a Che Guevara shirt, so there is like a segment of working-class people who are sympathetic to socialism.
Yeah, I think there's the older generation who like communism, some of them, who miss the good old days. But I think it's more this populism, you know, it's more that this feeling that the government should be taking care of people in some way. Because in general, you're not. You know, I mean, in general, you're poor, every man for himself, and the government, symbolically helping people certainly is a political winner. There's no doubt about that.
And what would you say are some of the fundamental principles of national economics? Oh, you mentioned one of them is state or local control of banks.
State or local control of banks, having your own currency, guaranteeing your own financial system with your national bank, producing local if you can. If you have the scale and the human capital, you should try to produce a domestic industry in any field where you're capable. I think those would be some of the more important ones.
In relation to the France situation, this idea that you have this sweeping managerial class and they're going to be in alliance with the urban proletariat immigrants, and that's going to be like a big pattern where they're going to be facing standoff against the rural dispossessed natives. So this seems to be a common political pattern, not just in France, but in the United States, and Grisha touched on that in one of his in a recent article of his.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean that's very plausible, and that seems to be the way things are going. Oh, by the way, there's one other thing I thought of. There's this weird pattern that the elites, the globalist elites, they seem to have heavily hate with their power for some reason, because Macron was raising the fuel taxes, and we've been sort of justifying it because taxes are too, well, I mean, yeah, France needs to budget it better, things better, but on the other hand, why are you raising fuel taxes if you're also cutting nuclear power?
Yeah, I agree with Anatoly. The fact that people hate nuclear power when we don't have, which means you're going to have to fire up your coal plants, it shows that people don't actually care about climate change. And that's all I have to say about that.
So, Guillaume, in your article, Economics of the Great Replacement, you continue with this kind of topic of how societies are judged purely on their GDP, and as opposed to other, which neglects other factors that are very important, but also it doesn't take into account the economic well-being of the citizen. But you also discuss the concepts of high globalism and low globalism and how they impact the nation and its economy. Can you explain those two concepts, high globalism and low globalism?
Sure. High globalism is about intelligent people across the globe connecting. So if you have an intelligent Cuban, say, he can move to the United States, and instead of languishing in Cuba, he can work for Google and thereby contribute to global innovation. And that's just one example, but it could be with any multinational corporation. You're basically eliminating national borders, increasing humanity's global collective intelligence, and creating more efficiencies, economic efficiencies in particular. So this is the globalism of startups. It's the globalism of doctors moving from poor countries to rich countries. And it's very powerful. You know, it's not something that we should scoff at. You know, many people will go for this because it's it actually works on a lot of levels. Low globalism is about equality. It's about social justice in the crude sense. It's about every person who is poorer than us in the third world wants to come to the first world to enjoy the better quality of life, notwithstanding the negative effect they have on the first world. And so people think that globalism works because they just emphasize the high globalism. They see that that works. They see that they work for, you know, they're in the top 20% of educated people. They work for a very multinational company or institution, and it works very well, and they live in a global city where there's a lot of wealth, and it, you know, there's a lot of inequality, there's a lot of social fragmentation, there's a lot of alienation, but let's overlook that. And they also overlook the low globalism, which I think is important because the failure to eliminate these ethnic inequalities, you know, it shows that heredity and race still matter.
This kind of overlaps with the two kind of agendas behind globalism. One agenda is purely economic and about neoliberal capitalism. They want unlimited immigration and free trade just to depress wages and to get cheap labor and cheap goods. Then there's also a sort of a left-wing version of globalism where they believe that the first world nations or the European nations, their wealth is a product of exploitation and colonialism, so they're obligated to open up their borders and redistribute their wealth. So there's these two ideologies driving that. Would you say the first one, you would say they're equally significant, or would you say the economic or capitalist version is more so?
That's a good question. It's hard to gauge how important each of those two strands is. My instinct would be to say that the high globalism would probably happen anyway. It's something that would be very hard to stop unless you had like very strong ideological reasons. But if you want a picture of what a high globalist society would look like, it would be something like Singapore. You know, you bring in smart people, you police them, and it works very well. And you can contrast Japan with the West. The fact that we've allowed all these, you know, unskilled, economically uninteresting, socially dangerous immigrants into the West, I think is mainly ideological. I don't think it's been done for economic reasons.
You've said that the United States has basically brain-drained the rest of the world. So obviously it's imported a large underclass, but you make that point.
Yeah, and I think this is why globalism can work in America and maybe is working better in America. I mean, it's a much richer country. It has a lot more dynamic industries. And if you look at where globalism is being challenged in Europe most effectively, it tends to be in the peripheral countries like Italy or Hungary, which themselves are being brain drained. But they don't have the economic resources to handle the immigration. And they're kind of rougher societies. So people are still a bit more human, a bit more tribal, and so the revolt is starting there. America has resources to redistribute. It can take the hits of all these Hispanics who you know, are not the worst immigrants in the world, by the way. But I mean, the basic theme of the article is that we're doomed because the psychological forces are, you know, people want more. People want infinity money. People in the third world want to come in. Businesses want to make money. And we don't have an ideology which would explain why we should stop any of this. You know, we don't have any set of values which would be able to give us sufficient will to, you know, say no. And the pressures are very strong. You know, it's people's livelihoods. And people think that if I make another 100 euros or 200 euros, I'll be better off. But the fact is that basically the more money people have, the more money they spend to have a quote-unquote normal, you know, socially acceptable lifestyle. And so it's a never-ending chase. People always want more money.
Guillaume, you wrote about crime rates in France in this Owns Review article, France is Becoming Dangerous. And a lot of people on the dissident right have this, they talk about this kind of Mad Max scenario that they talk about like France and Sweden as if it's this constant war zone. And obviously mass immigration into Europe has had a negative effect. But would you say a lot of these dissident right people, when they talk about crime in Europe, do they exaggerate? Do you think they do exaggerate crime and violence for political agendas?
Well, I think the politicians will certainly exaggerate it for their political agenda. I think the people who are doing it on websites, nationalist news websites, I don't think they're doing it so much for the agenda as that they are, psychologically prone to these sorts of stories and to a sense of moral panic. There is obviously much more crime in Europe because there has been a lot of feral immigration. There are a lot of horror stories, especially in the UK, with the mass rape and grooming cases, which are really blood-curdling, and the sheer scale of them is kind of hard to fathom. Thousands of girls, really. But broadly speaking, Europe is a lot less violent than North America or Latin America. And, you know, people are pretty docile. You do get terrorist attacks, horrible ones, on the Promenade des Anglais in Nice or in the Bataclan, where, you know, 1 to 6 Muslims can kill between 1 and 200 people, and this is kind of the new normal. It's just considered normal that Europeans could be slaughtered en masse by Muslims. For our ancestors, this would be quite unthinkable that we wouldn't do anything to stop this. But the actual overall crime rate is not so high, but interestingly enough, at least according to this Libération article on the latest police statistics, there has been a 20% increase in homicide in France, excluding terrorist attacks, over the past year or so. In previous years, 2015, 2016, there had been a 20% spike in homicide because of these terrorist attacks. But now, even in the absence of terrorist attacks, the homicide rate has stayed the same, which means that the normal day-to-day murder and killing has gone up by 20% in a year, which is really quite remarkable. We're not really sure what the cause is. I don't think the cause is, like in the U.S., the Ferguson effect, where Barack Obama blamed the police for black crime, effectively, and caused a decline in policing, demoralized the police officers, and led to a big spike in crime, especially black crime. It could be related to the migrant invasion, where there was a big spike in crime in Germany, where we know it was related to the massive influx of unstable and aggressive foreigners. There's also been an increase in crime in London. So, I mean, it's definitely part of a pattern, but it's hard to know exactly what is causing this.
So yeah, obviously things are getting worse because of the migrant crisis and immigration in general in regards to crime. But you were saying overall Western Europe is still relatively safe if you compare it to major American cities. Well, especially like Chicago, but it's hard to say because I did read that London's now more dangerous than New York. So but compared to the United States, if you were just to compare the United States in general, you would still say it's overall relatively safer?
I mean, it's very remarkable that London is more violent than New York now. I mean, that's a huge change. I mean, really remarkable change. On the whole, it's still much less violent. I mean, you just need to look at the homicide rate, or you just need to look at how you go around. You know, you go to any American city, you need to be careful what neighborhood you go to. There are certain neighborhoods you just should not go to. And that goes for Washington, D.C. as much as, Los Angeles. But in Europe, there are rough neighborhoods, but, you know, you don't need to have as much care, usually. And I say that as someone who has lived in big European cities.
You wrote about the French intellectual Alain Sorel, and he's an interesting figure. He's a French civic nationalist, and anti-Zionist, and he has a significant following with a lot of minority groups, including Arabs and Africans. I mean, I don't agree with Sorrell's ideology per se, but I do think these types of I guess you may actually make the comparison to Venezuela, and Venezuela is a country. It's a left wing version of civic nationalism. It's anti-globalist, so it doesn't necessarily reflect my ideology, but I do think it's significant because it further breaks down the left-right paradigm, and it does challenge the establishment, so I think that's interesting.
Yeah, Sorrell has been around for a long time. He's been able to single-handedly make a whole subculture in France. He was part of my path to nationalism. He can explain the merits of the nation state, but he's a bit, I would not put him in charge of the country, put it that way. I think it would lead to problems.
Yeah, and obviously Venezuela is an adversary of neoliberal globalism, but at the same time it's not a country I'd want to emulate either.
Yeah, I think you can have these sorts of things if you have a functional European society, you know. I mean, he has admired Hugo Chavez. I've admired Hugo Chavez. He admires Vladimir Putin, and he's admired Charles de Gaulle. So the you know, you can have a social nationalism if it's done in the right way with a certain moderation. Charles de Gaulle could do that, but in Venezuela, it hasn't worked out so well. The problem is egalitarianism. If you remove egalitarianism from your mode of thinking, you'll be fine.
Well, Cuba has a similar demographic profile to Venezuela to some degree. And I mean, obviously, I wouldn't want to live in Cuba, but Cuba is managed. It's much better managed than Venezuela, and it's also more authoritarian.
I've been meaning to write an article, Anatoly, about the effectiveness of totalitarian white power in Cuba. It really works pretty well.
Of totalitarian white power. That's an interesting way of describing Cuba. I'm looking forward to that.
Because its demographics are pretty bad, and yet it has the lowest crime rate in Latin America. It's very stable. People have a pretty high life expectancy. And they're even able to be independent from the U.S. and to do the occasional foreign intervention. I mean, they're definitely on their downward trend. But it got me thinking about how, you know, if our societies really got completely multiculturalized, you know, if you had an authoritarian government, actually, you could probably just keep things in line pretty well.
So, yeah, I mean, I'd be interested to hear you also address the historical issues, because the image that has been painted of Cuba as a banana republic before the revolution, it's, as I understand it, it's mostly false. I mean, it was relatively advanced in the region, actually.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know much about pre-communist Cuba, actually. So would you say, Anatoly, that Cuba's human capital was higher than the average in Latin America, and that's why it's been able to do things?
I think it was, yes. And I mean, Cuba was one of the most, it was more developed than Mexico, probably somewhere along the lines of Argentina back in the 1950s. I mean, I'm just like recalling statistics on the fly, but it was somewhere around that ballpark. So yes, I assume that its human capital was relatively high by regional standards.
With the whole kind of ideology of a left-wing populist civic nationalism that includes people of different ethnic backgrounds, if it were to take off in, say, the United States, and you had a figure like that, would it break up the whole kind of current coalition that we have, the coalition of the fringes, and the kind of top-down alliance between the neoliberal elite and the different minority groups? I don't know about the kind of actual policies that movement would implement and how beneficial they would be, but from a standpoint From a political standpoint, it would break up that kind of coalition. So I do think it would be very fascinating to see that kind of movement come about in the United States, and what impact would it have? If you look at Ocasio-Cortez, she definitely doesn't fit that model because she's an SJW and a globalist, but she is pushing this radical left-wing economic agenda that's still putting her at odds with the neoliberal elite. So how would that kind of movement that's a multi-ethnic left-wing civic nationalism play out if it were to catch on in the United States, and how would it change the political dichotomy?
Well, I don't see it being very viable, so it's hard to say much about it. I mean, Ocasio-Cortez is a good example where, you know, she's very pro-immigration, very pro-minority, and she wants to redistribute wealth, basically. And that's fine. I think the U.S. can redistribute wealth. I think it makes sense from her point of view. But why would she become anti-immigration? Why should she identify with the U.S. as a, you know, as a entity distinct from the world? I mean, she has no reason to do that, and most people on the left have no reason to do that. I mean, maybe we can be surprised, but I've not seen it.
Yeah, I don't think her... I definitely would not want her in a position of power, but a lot of people on the right just have a strong dislike for her. I do think people like her play a role in causing division between the different factions of the left, including the...
I mean, I am curious if not her personally, but that kind of politics maybe is the way for the future, because if and when Florida and Texas flip Democrat, having this sort of social democratic politics will be very easy to implement, and America can do it. Like, there is lots of wealth to go around, and I kind of fear that, to the extent that I think it would pacify and domesticate people, make America less dynamic. I'm worried that they would get into a very sustainable sweet spot of social democracy. Because what you would want is that they would not just have a moderate social democracy where everybody, you know, is fed and, you know, fat, dumb, and happy, but we would want the left to go too far and, you know, really scare people and, you know, really wreck the economy. But I'm not sure they would do that, but we'll see.
Before I wrap up the show, Guillaume and Anatoly, do you have any thing you'd like to add about what outcomes you see that will come out of the Yellow Vest movement?
Well, it's very hard to say, but I think it could be a major step towards breaking down the ghettoization of the far right and of the nationalist right, and it could get the dialogue going between the right and the left and the rest of society. And as much as it may seem unrealistic today, we can see in Italy that this kind of pure populist movement, like the Five Star Movement, is actually willing to even govern with a far-right nationalist party. So I don't think we should be closed-minded. We don't know what's going to happen, and certain barriers are certainly breaking down, and the governments really don't have a grip on the situation. I mean, it's really falling apart in Germany, in France, in Britain also. I mean, just about everywhere, the governments have no grip on things. They don't know what they're doing. So we can be fairly hopeful.
Mm. Well, let me just give my two cents on the Chile issue. I'm pretty skeptical for a number of reasons. So I think outright coup scenarios can be fully ruled out because, if you look at actual revolutions, then typically you need some part of the elites to go over, otherwise it's just a peasant's bund. And it doesn't seem like there's any parts of the French elites, I mean the real French elites, who sympathize with them. So this seems to be more like a Jacques Levy than like a real threat. Secondly, unfortunately, the
the French, if you look at the opinion polls on immigration and stuff like that, then the French, they're not as cucked as like the Germans or the Swedes, but they're still pretty cucked, like much more so than Italians even. So yeah, there's interesting things happening in Italy, but France still needs to develop to that point. And I mean, yeah, and, it's like a like Le Pen and the National Front who keep coming in second, and dustling Jimmy's amongst the globalists all the time. But then you realize that all the other people band together behind the leftists or the neoliberal or whatever, just against the National Front, and it's still two against one. So the math never works out. So yeah, I'm pretty skeptical about the Yellow Vests actually.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Guillaume Dorache and Anatoly Karlin for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.
Okay, well, yeah. Thanks for having me on.